Yeah, Olga, this has been a little while coming, hasn't it?
Yeah, and
How? Go on, sir.
well, I wish I, to be honest, I was hoping that there would be I would have by this point had the opportunity to read through a bit of McLuhan, but to be honest, I set myself a reading list when I was on holiday, but I ended up getting stuck in some work that I was doing, and I actually found his writing to be quite difficult to get through. I will go back there. I think that there, I mean, there might be a feeling that I can possibly speak about, but the caveat is that I might have like completely misunderstood. But still, I think what little I think I might have gleaned from that relates to some of what you've talked about, even in your podcast. So yeah. I'm hoping that this is not the
No, that's
last time.
great. Yeah, we can always do it again. And don't worry at all about not reading McLuhan, because I have not read McLuhan at all. And so I'm very interested to learn about him. Actually, I was just speaking with Elena the other day about him, and she was talking about how difficult he is to read, and about how some of the secondary literature can actually be, somehow more useful than reading the thing itself. So I don't know if you had that experience, but
Possibly.
yeah.
I will tell you this. So there's a book that I got recently, which I came across it completely accidentally. I think it's really not very well known. I'm just going to take a look at it now because I want to make sure I get the title correct. It's got a strange title. It's called Cybernetics of the Sacred. And gosh,
Oh, wow.
yeah, we're gonna like it's a small book. It's extremely occult in the sense that like I'm not entirely sure what it's about, but it does seem to be about sort of the weird overlap between medium and the meaning. So there's this whole stuff about like videotape and information and all this other stuff. So the reason I mention
That's
this,
fascinating.
it's really, really interesting. And the reason that I mention this is because towards the start, what because I literally got it over the front like in the post a couple of days ago, but in the start, this guy, Paul Ryan, the writer, he makes mention of having spent a year studying under McLuhan. And
Oh, wow.
so he's quoted as saying, what did you learn with McLuhan during this time? And what he responds with is that it's not so much about the content that McLuhan gave him, it is more about the way of seeing that he gave him. So it's not so much about the information as it is like, yeah, the framing, which I think, to be honest, I think that kind of just supports maybe the relative like obscurity of how he writes. And so it's not about the information, it's about how you look at things. So I find that quite attractive. And that's what makes me slightly more confident about the fact that I might be understanding it to some extent through, some amount of practical experience with media.
So that's Cybernetics of the Sacred by Paul
That's
Ryan.
right, yeah.
Okay. This is actually surprisingly similar to what Isabella and I were talking about in the past week. Do you want to say anything about that, Isabella, or?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, just that we've become increasingly interested, and I did not know that McLuhan sort of talked about this about spirituality, religious practices, and technology, and the interface there. And I'm furiously looking for my pen right now, which is why you caught me off the mic, because I wanted to make sure that we dive into that. So thank you for that reference, because it's super interesting.
Yeah, so Olga, you and I were speaking sort of about metaphor a few months ago, and I was saying that Julian Jaynes has a big section that's quite hard to follow. It's got metaphor and metaphrand and what is it? Paraphier, and I can't remember. There's like four terms that he uses. I can pull it up if it's interesting, but I don't think I've ever been able to fully understand what he's on about. So it may not be that useful. But also, Ian McGilchrist kind of has this, it seems like a kind of overriding assumption that metaphor is something that the right hemisphere is doing. Whereas the left hemisphere tends to misunderstand or dislike metaphors for some reason. And then I think, so Zarina was working on a She read Heidegger's Introduction to Metaphysics, and he talks to at some length about metaphor as well. And so we were looking, as you do, if you know, Heidegger always tends to go back to etymology, and so I think for that reason we were looking at where it actually comes from. And so there's this idea of like carrying a cross, but it used to mean something like transfer of ownership, or over a cross, and the bear kind of means carry. So there's a sense of like transferring something or carrying from one place to another, maybe across domains, I guess is the kind of sense of a metaphor, right? Like it's, you've got a meaning in one place and then a kind of thing that you're referring to in another place. And then this act of joining them crosses over or transfers a meaning from one domain to another, something like that. And I guess it used to mean more like a transfer of property, but then it came to mean like carrying over a boundary or something like that. So I don't know, does any of that resonate, or have you looked into, I guess, how did you get interested in the topic?
Okay, maybe? So this is the last time I'll say this. I do struggle to talk about this. I've experienced a lot of this by working on things and trying to make things. But, basically, at any point, if I just get confusing, just do tell me, because I am nervous about this. That aside, so I was listening to your podcast, and actually that was one of the things that I picked up on, this notion of transportation. This was really interesting to me, because I became interested in metaphor through the most ass-backwards way you can imagine. I really didn't expect that that would be an interesting thing to me. I landed there as the result of doing visual experimentation. I was messing around with a concept where I wanted to record a dance and create this sort of half animation, half video thing with one dancer who ends up being many dancers through the manipulation of of the sequence, because this has been done before. So for example, I don't know if you've ever heard of Norma McLaren. Norma McLaren was probably, you know, top five animators of the 20th century. He did lots of like short things. It was never especially long form. He was like the Scottish animator who worked just before the World War II, and then ended up going to Canada. And then he worked for the National Film Board of Canada. I think that like literally the reason that they're even known is because of him. So he did all these strange sketches. And towards the end of his life, or later on in life, he started becoming very interested in dance. And so I started to do something similar. And what I noticed was that when I was thinking about what the implications of the dance would be, like, God, this is really hard to explain, but I noticed that as far as I was concerned, to me, the repetition that I could see in folk dance in Russia was reminiscent of some national features, which is conformity, you know, strength through conformity, strength through everybody behaving the same way. And you can kind of see that strange repetition in dance. And then I thought about the implications of that, because when you actually imagine one person being many, it got very creepy to me. Like at that point, I was thinking, oh my God, you know, if I show something, if all I show is a sequence of a person making a bunch of movements, suddenly the way that I treat this footage and the way it comes out, it does not just look like a person performing a set of movements. It is actually reminiscent of something else. So that's probably sounds quite strange, but that's what got me like wondering, because suddenly I realized that you could communicate something much greater through what is really a fairly simple sequence. And so here, when you talk about the notion of transference, so to me, like a metaphor is compression, right? What you're doing is you're trying to collapse something very complex, something very rich, into a line that through its accuracy, somehow you're able to plot a line which can be translated back into something much bigger. It's like WinRAR, right? You compress and then you decompress, and suddenly, despite the fact that the relative set of data points is really quite small, by interacting with it, you can make it much greater in your head. So in that sense, I really can't tell you exactly why, but this reminds me, there's a sequence in Event Horizon. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's a horror film where I saw somebody say this recently, actually. It's really funny. They said that's one of the most enduring features of Event Horizon is how they demonstrate the space travel. That's, you know, you take a sheet of paper, you fold it in half, and then you take a pen and you thrust the pen through this sheet, these two like folded sheets of paper, which means that you go from one end of the galaxy to the other with minimal effort. And I think it's a lot like that, this notion of compression, that you don't have to go very far to suddenly end up somewhere completely different. So this is where I think the metaphor aspect is so interesting, right? Because what you're doing is you're efficiently saving time. You're going somewhere completely different, somewhere that might be remote, somewhere you haven't been before. But actually, you're taking some kind of shortcut to there. You're bending space and time, and you're going somewhere else mentally.
And so this is like, okay, I see. So kind of, if you fold a sheet of paper in half, then you're bringing two parts that are quite remote into contact with each other. And the compression element, is that related to the sort of folding, or is it more like,
I think it's the piercing.
The piercing. Okay.
Yeah, and the folding. I think it's both. Like, I think it's the same thing. But the point is that what would have otherwise been, if you'd otherwise like drawn a straight line with a ruler from one point to the other, it is like, you know, 20 centimeters, you fold the sheet in half and actually you cover less than a millimeter. Like suddenly the amount of efficiency that you're granted, you cover all that distance through the fraction of the effort.
Yeah, I love that idea because, yeah, this folding of space-time, but also bringing something in contact.
Yes, you align them. It's like an isomorphism.
Wow, that's amazing. It's an interesting one. I because there's sort of some theorists that are saying, well, all, you know, like, and the further, I think Heidegger would probably say this, which is like, almost all language takes on this metaphorical quality of, you know, you kind of extend and extend and extend its domain until it becomes almost like, it becomes very abstract. It's like what was once very concrete and referred to a very specific thing comes to refer to, like, to be used across so many domains that it almost like loses contact with its original referent or something like that, you know? One that I've been talking about recently is just this idea that, you know, what's true in English, apparently true in English comes from like the same etymology as tree. And so it's originally like a kind of solidity comparison. So basically you're saying what is true is what is reliable or solid or tree-like, you know, in the sense that you can kind of like lean against it. But then that becomes abstracted into, you know, what's true of what, you know, like what's a true statement about, you know, where my house is becomes equated with what's true, you know, in some kind of mathematical equation or something like that. And then we say, and then we abstract it as if these two forms of truth are equal, but they might not be. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, and then you've lost the sense of the solidity of the tree entirely, right? I don't know if that resonates at all.
I'm not sure. Maybe. I mean, maybe we should keep going because I'm not sure I understand that so well.
Is there a way and to I put feel... my hand up without interrupting
yes.
you guys?
No, please interrupt us. And likewise, anyone who's listening who wants to come up and talk, please come up. Isabella, go on.
Yeah, so I'm super turned on by what you just said, Olga. And in part, it's because I'm very into Douglas Hofstadter's talking about or writing about cognition as analogy. He basically thinks that all thinking is done through analogy. Everything is a chunking of category into categories, and interactions with other people kind of have the potential to break your categories. They usually don't. They, in fact, only reify them. But one of the things that there's a couple of things that you said that were interesting, but it's this efficiency to go really far with metaphor. So this idea of going fast and far by simply using metaphor, which gets you in an entirely different and yet connected and associative place, right? And so there's something novel, Sorry, can you hear me? Yeah. So there's something novel that emerges through these new connections, right? Mm-hmm. That you make a metaphor into and can blow whole entire disciplines up, you know, by, you know, Einstein made these metaphors that suddenly turned our sense of time upside down and so on. So I think this idea that you have here is really interesting about this importance of metaphor. And what I wanted to ask you is if you minded to go back to the folk dancing and how that's related, because I feel like it's at the tip of my brain, but I don't quite get it yet.
Yeah, I do struggle to enunciate that. But so, okay, I'm going to mention somebody that Brian is acquainted with probably twice today. It's Heron Stone, because this is related to something that I got from him. So Heron Stone is a gentleman that Brian and I are friends with. We've had like a bunch of conversations with him. He's a regular in Clubhouse and he's a linguist. He's especially interested he's very interested in metaphor. He thinks it's key, but really he's looking at what he calls the language machine. Like he basically focuses on the way that language shapes us. He thinks that, you know, we're a bunch of brain damaged language monkeys that are thinking that everything is, you know, that language is almost like a parasite, right? Like it is very useful. And he thinks it began as this bunch of, you know, ways of giving directions, basically. But he also thinks that it's something that takes over and then takes over without us even noticing. So after talking to him on a number of occasions, he likes to go on about the word the, for example, right? He says, you know, what is the truth? What is the solution? Always pointing out that once you actually start paying attention to what the word the means, then suddenly you're noticing that there's like a whole bunch of implicit assumptions that are highly problematic that we really usually take for granted. So we were talking about this, and I started thinking about Russian, because Russian is my first language. We don't have the word there in Russian. We have like a whole bunch of ways that we circumvent the problem that the solves. Somehow it is rarely a problem, which is quite interesting. But then I started thinking about, well, what does this mean? You know, what does it mean when you take out the word the from the equation? And so either if you take something very simple as the example of you walk into a room, you know, go into that room and bring me the green chair. And so we don't have that. And I was just translating it back and forth. And then I thought, well, I thought that it was quite interesting that there is no way of, apart from saying that one, this notion of something being the thing is just not really something that is a big part of the language. And it gets, to me, this gets really wiggly, right? Because again, I'm actually Russian-Ukrainian, but I'm mostly Russian. And so for me, like lately I've been noticing that I've been thinking about what does being Russian mean? What is the Russianness? And I think that this is something that expresses itself in lots of different branches. It expresses itself in folk art, right? In embroidery, in patterns that are etched into wood, into houses, into all kinds of things. And these patterns, they have this very repetitive nature. And this repetitive nature, I mean, you could probably say the same thing about all types of folk art, but there, like to me, there's definitely something there about repetition and about strength and order being found in something being repeated over and over again. And looking at language, I think that it is not so surprising to me then that things stand out less, that the notion of embedded significance is not there, because I guess the individual nature of things is maybe less important, or maybe you don't want to highlight it or something. And so like in the example of the dancer, right? The reason that I thought up this project is because I'd been looking at the video, a very famous dance, it's called Berezka, I mean, maybe it's called Berezka, I'm not sure, where you basically have lots of young women, let's say there's 20 young women, they're all wearing the same outfit. They're all wearing, they're the same height, they're wearing the same outfit, and they're all performing the same movement. They're just at slightly different angles to each other. And the way that they move is they sort of float, right? And it looks, for the life of me, a lot like some other types of art. Like I was at the time, I was looking at oscilloscope music and like oscilloscope art, where a very complex pattern is drawn by using just one beam. So here it was fascinating to me that you had to have a whole dance where each person is the same. One person is many, many are the same. But the point is that the reason that the dance works is because they're all the same. If you make all of these people different, if there's any kind of individual features to them, the dance is no longer so striking. And so this dance is almost like a strange reinforcement of the importance, not of homogeneity exactly, but of everybody being the same and not sticking out of line. And so like given recent events, you might understand why this was extremely chilling, because I was describing this dance, this notion of mine, this project to my friend who's Kazakh. I was telling her that, you know, you have the one person and I can make it so that I multiply this one person. And we basically imitate that, the same dance, using just the one person, just like an oscilloscope beam. It creates this fantastical shape that looks like one long line, but it's actually one dot. And I was telling her about this and she told me how creepy it sounded. And she was right. It was incredibly creepy. Mm. We both felt it because somehow this was an echo of the same like forced homogenization that you hear sometimes. And it was weirdly terrifying, and yet it was so firmly embedded to the point where, you know, we all grew up with it. So here, yeah, that's why I'm interested in metaphor. It was the weirdest thing. It was the fact that somehow the history that I grew up with, somehow all these things, all these feelings could be expressed in one very simple movement.
Mm. And would you say it's like related to collective action or...
what do you mean?
Kind of. Well, I guess what I've been thinking about whether, you know, we kind of have this baseline assumption that the individual is the sort of unit that we care about rather than the group.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other ways of looking at this and saying, well, you know, it might be the case that defining features of humanity or whatever are first collective and then and only later individuated. Mm. And there's an argument in Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Dancing in the Streets, which is like, it's a history of collective joy. And so she's looking at these moments of, I guess Emile Durkheim writes about like collective effervescence or whatever. And so basically these moments of ecstatic dancing and things like that. And she starts at the kind of beginning and says, well, what if this is the original form of art and it's not really an art at all? It's actually, you know, the dance even precedes music, and the dance is a way of expressing collective movement in order to scare off animals that can't, like, if you're basically like moving enough in sync, then they will just kind of assume that you are one big thing, basically.
Yeah.
And so then there's this idea that this ability to synchronize and imitate and move completely in sync with one another is one of the defining features of what it means to cooperate and to, you know, to be a social, to be the type of social animal that we are, and that it's like somehow this deep evolutionary thing. I'm probably not doing her argument justice, and I think
I understand
someone else's argument, but
I think I understand you correctly. Yes, please continue.
No, so it was just, I guess one of my questions was like, you know, you said it's creepy, but could, you know, like, could it also be sort of primeval, or could it, you know, like, could it have a kind of power that comes from some kind of like deep-seated familiarity, you know, the idea, the Heimlich unheimlich thing in Freud, which is that somehow the things that are the most creepy are also the things that are closest to home or the closest to the most familiar in some sense. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it is only creepy because of context. It wouldn't be creepy if it weren't for the fact that it weren't somehow some kind of strange echo. Like in this case, I think it then acts as quite a straightforward metaphor. Like it is something where I think the main difference is because you and I have talked about this a little bit, the notion of, so yes, strength is found in repetition. Strength is found in something that everybody does at the same time. If you build a brick wall, you don't want one brick to be sticking out in a different way. So obviously there's something robust about such great big connective networks for sure. It's just that where it becomes problematic is when it's forced, right? It's when this pattern does not emerge on its own, but rather when this pattern that has somehow ossified over time, is then stamped forcibly over something and does not emerge on its own. I think that's where it becomes creepy. It's not so much the repetition, it is the fact that it is being enforced. And that is where, and that also is when it becomes scary, right? Like in any community where you have a lot of conformity, where you have a lot of like, you know, shared rituals, it is wonderful when you choose to partake into this, but actually, The problem probably arises when you are forced to partake in it, or when you force somebody else to take part.
Yes, I can completely understand that. And you spoke about the strength of it. This is something that Nietzsche writes about in terms of the strong society kind of homogenizes, and its risk is stupidity, which is that it kind of ignores dissent and charges forward in this same direction. But almost like the extent to which it's able to eliminate dissent entirely, which Nietzsche calls degenerates, like is the degree to which it will kind of destroy itself, basically, you know, because you need this kind of, I don't know whether it's like, maybe like if you're exploiting, then you need to be able to switch to exploring, and you need to be able to switch strategies, and the degree to which you stamp out dissent prevents that kind of switching or something like
that. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think that's I think that's something. Okay, so again, sorry, I have to go back to what I know. And I was reading about what Bilibin, who's one of my favorite artists, he studied the progress of Russian folk art from, like, you know, I don't know, like, I think he mostly focused on the 17th century, but he was looking at what happened to folk art between the 17th century and the beginning of the 20th century, when he was writing this text. So he was looking at the span of several hundred years, and he was talking about how there was a certain period of progression when family after family, cycle after cycle, like, you know, for hundreds of years over this great big expanse of land, you had people generating folk art. You had families who would, they would sit at home and they would embroider and they would create art for themselves. And somehow there was a progression that happened when you would pass things down between generations, and also, I guess, in your own village. These villages were all sort of scattered around. So although you had a lot of common features, the fact is that there were lots of little pockets of development that had similar features, but there was still some kind of movement there. They were passed down, and probably that meant smaller changes through time. And what Bilibin was saying was that he was basically lamenting the fact that folk art was dying. Like, he was writing this in like 1905 or something like that. And he was saying, yes, it was tremendously sad that folk art came to a relative stop. And he was basically saying this, that the reason this happened is because, of course, aristocracy would take on trends from the West, and they would bring things in from the outside. And what happened was this disrupted the patterns that had been evolving on their own throughout the years. So on the one hand, he was saying that this is, you know, so sad, it interrupted this beautiful progress, something that had been taking place over all this time, and that it was interrupted. But at the same time, he was saying that, well, I think he might have actually been quoting Tsiolkovsky. I think Tsiolkovsky at one point, who was a rocket designer, he was one of the first figures to work on the notion of space travel, of like propulsion into the atmosphere. Tsiolkovsky had at one point written something along the lines of, you know, it is safe to be in the cradle, but one cannot stay in the cradle forever. And that was what Bilibin said. He quoted him on this, saying that it is wonderful to get this progression that is local, but in the end, you must still move onwards. And you and I have also talked about this notion that if you have a pattern that is not disrupted ever, if it is always continuing, at some point there will be some kind of like colony collapse or something like that. So you must have some kind of deviation every so often that is incorporated. Otherwise, it does not last.
Yeah. And this disruption of the kind of folklore tradition, I was thinking of Tarkovsky, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, in Andrei Rublev, there's this kind of central contradiction, right, between Christianity and these much older sort of pagan rituals that are going on out in the forest, and yet they're kind of, it's not, I don't know, I suppose they like coexist at that time, but you get the sense that this can't continue somehow, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is interesting because there's a real reverence there, isn't there? It's so beautiful. It's something that he looks upon And on the one hand, it is obviously within the context of the film, it is something that is seen as dangerous and bad, but Tarkovsky sees it, despite the fact that he's religious himself, he sees it with beauty. He looks at it with this great wonder. He thinks it's wonderful, and he thinks it is so brutal and terrible when the attack occurs.
Matyash, did you want to?
Yes.
Hello. Hello. Welcome.
Just for people that know me, I'm coming live from a Wendy's in Austin, Texas. It's 11:30 outside. The sun is blazing. So in terms of metaphor, I find it, again, it's sort of such a fascinating topic because I've always found the concept to be both like related with like sort of language psychology, but also to things like computers and math, because math people in general are sort of big on this idea of like isomorphism and so on, one question that I guess I had is, I speak Slovenian, and I've always thought of Slovenian as being sort of a much more like metaphorical language than English. Like people just use a lot these sort of exaggerated metaphors, I guess, a lot more often than they do in English. That's how I experience the language. And I'm just sort of curious, how do you before you were sort of saying, okay, on some level sort of all language is metaphorical, but it does often feel to me like it is possible to sort of be kind of closer or further away from reality in various ways, where I don't know, like for example, this whole idea of a chair in some sense feels closer to reality than like the idea of capitalism, which is kind of everywhere and nowhere at the same time. So I don't know, I was just kind of curious how you sort of think about those types of relationships.
That's a great question. And I'm really curious about this issue of the degree to which languages are metaphorical. And Slovenian is it a Slavic language?
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know. Again, this is just sort of my experience of it. Like, it could just be that like this impression is in large part driven by, I don't know, that language like was really influenced by Romanticism or something like that, and people were like super metaphorical back then. But that's sort of the vibe as I experience it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I just read a very brief thing on Wikipedia when I was looking at the entry for metaphor, and it was saying, oh yeah, the Indo-European languages start using metaphors intensively relatively late. And it said like in the 15th century, whereas the Semitic languages, like in Hebrew, it's going on all the time in the Old Testament, you know, the Lord is my rock kind of thing. And so that's like, you know, it's almost, I guess that's what, at least 2000 years, maybe 2500 years before or something like that. So it's an interesting idea to think of metaphor itself as a kind of technology, and when it gets adopted by different languages, and also as a kind of affordance that might be used by different languages, even if they're under the same, overall, you know, I guess both English and the Slavic languages are both Indo-European, right? I'm not the right person to ask about this, because I think everyone else who's on stage and many of the people in the audience speak a lot more languages than I do. So I'd be curious to hear, Olga, if you find Russian more metaphorical, or Isabella, if you find Romanian more metaphorical than English.
Well, I think that there might be two things as far as I'm concerned to mention. The first is that there is, I think, a certain melodic nature to Russian that is not so observable in English. There's something about the repetition and the sounds of it and the syllables that have like a sing-songy almost feel to that, that when you recite fairy tales, for example, you can almost half sing them. So there's that, but then this is quite an old feature. And there's been great lengths taken to formalize Russian, to really nail down all the rules. Like if you study it in school, there's a constant debate about this possible simplification of rules and other things, and it's always met with like massive backlash, because the notion is that you cannot quite possibly, you can never ever change the sacred thing that is the Russian language. And I think that whatever metaphorical form it could have, I think that this sort of very enforced rigidity means that actually you cannot express yourself so freely. But the other thing that I think is very interesting is that English, although maybe it's not as quite as metaphorical, what is different about English compared to Russian is the fact that the capacity to make puns is incredible. So there's like this fluid nature. You can just like spin it around and twist it and you can do anything. And you have all the like innuendo and double entendre. Like, my God, you can make anything out of English.
That's amazing.
Would you say that's a language feature though, or just that like, I don't know, there is more of a culture of people doing
100%
puns in English
culture.
Though? Okay.
Yeah, and what's interesting around Romanian is also a very lyrical romance language, of course, very, well, I think the closest to Latin that there is out there, and it is absolutely full of metaphor. In fact, there's so much that happens around, you know, sort of staking your claim of where you are from by using certain types of metaphors or idioms and also jokes and so on that are very language-based to sort of identify and place oneself in that culture. And I think one of the other really interesting things is like the importance of poetry in some of these languages to break the familiarization, right? The familiar lyric with a sort of just the purpose of metaphor in poetry, at least could be argued, is this defamiliarization. I know, Brian, you're going to tell me who said that because I keep forgetting. And I think that's
Viktor
really
Shklovsky.
Important. Thank you. because Olga, you were talking about this kind of homogenized or sort of homogenization, this kind of hypnotic or mesmerizing sameness that happens, right? And so we'd want that something like our poets to kind of have us all to basically break that spell and show us a kind of different perspective of what's going on and so on with language, but also even underneath it with perception and so on. So that's just what struck me.
Yes, I completely agree, which is why contemporary Russian rebel poets were massively rejected by the government and then later on co-opted when it was much more convenient. But the point is that they were very much dangerous and difficult when they were creating these works precisely because they were changing and breaking things with their words.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
One sort of metaphor, I don't know if this is a good example of a metaphor, but I've just been thinking a lot about this issue of the laws of physics or the laws of nature at various points in the last sort of 1,000 years, and whether this is like a metaphor for human laws, and if it is, then like what is going on there? Like, you know, there's, I suppose, like early on you have these kind of semi-divine lawmakers, certainly in Mesopotamia and sort of, you know, Hammurabi and stuff like that, and it's pretty old stuff. I think it's like 17 something BC. And then in China, you've got these kind of early, lawmakers as well. I think a lot of cultures have this. And then we know some more recent ones like Draco or Solon or whatever in, you know, 600 BC, something like that in Greece. But also I guess maybe there's a sense that there's a divine law coming through these people. But then, of course, like laws are things that humans, I guess, kind of come up with or enforce or something like that. And so then, you know, I guess what I've been wondering is like, are these lawmakers successful because I think we have this image of them that they are wise and then they impose these kind of top-down regulations and that they're so smart that these must have come from a god and therefore they have to be obeyed for some kind of religious reason. But it seems to me like taking a kind of cultural evolutionary view that it must just be that, you know, almost like a Darwinian understanding, which is that a lot of people tried out a bunch of different laws. Some of those societies collapsed for reasons relating to the laws or maybe not relating to the laws. And then the ones that persist like get imitated. And there is a kind of explicit imitation going on within a lot of legal systems where you base, you know, Romans sort of imitating Greeks or Germans imitating Romans or, you know, things like that. And so, then I guess what I'm wondering is like, where does that transition happen where we say, okay, well now there's now what we think is that there are these laws of nature, like what, you know, it does that posit a kind of godlike authority and the understanding is that it's top down, or is it something that's like bottom up determined? And once you kind of get rid of the authority potentially of God, then what is the source of authority for these laws? I don't know if anyone has any thoughts on that.
Yeah. So my battery is at 2%, so I might die at any moment. But this is a subject I could go like on a long rant about, because this cultural artifact of like referring to various physical facts as laws is very, very interesting. Like, and you can kind of see that there was sort of a fashion to it and a kind of a sort of ebb and flow to it. Because, for example, like in like, I don't know, 19th century, I guess, or 18th century, like this idea of laws was very popular and everybody kind of wanted to have like their own little law. So you have things like Ohm's law or Snell's law, right? Things that nobody would call laws today, because like at some point it sort of, I think, fell out of fashion, right? And so you don't have like the Schrodinger's law or conservation of energy law. I mean, I guess you sort of double, you know, now we just have like the Schrodinger equation or something like that. So I just wanted to point out to this like interesting sort of cultural artifact of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's really fascinating, the idea that it might just be like a kind of phase that we went through that has hung around in some places, but not in others. Welcome, Jory.
Hey, thanks. I just had a comment about the laws and in particular gravity, because it's like it's a pretty interesting linguistic story, which is like gravity, the idea of something being grave was originally a metaphor before it was a physical force. So we talked about things being grave or the gravity of a situation, meaning that there was a weight to certain experiences that felt heavier than others. And so so gravity was related to this idea of weight as a metaphoric concept before we discovered the law of gravity. And the law of gravity was actually named after the metaphor, you know, that because we have these bodies and that they feel as if things are getting heavier when we have more intense situations, then we appropriated that concept to talk about physical, you know, structures that, if you know, affect each other with mass.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, the gravitas kind of emotional sensation of it, right? Like the just seriousness of the situation or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Grave is serious. It's a couple steps. Grave meaning serious. Serious meaning weighty. Weighty meaning the experience, the physical experience we have in our body when someone tells us, you know, something serious. That's really important. So, I mean, this all kind of comes from, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the Mark Johnson, George Lakoff book, Metaphors We Live By, but that was a pretty important book that really considered metaphor as a conceptual structure and not just kind of a flourish of language. And so we use it to think about the world largely by appropriating our physical experiences of our body, you know, so largely like where embodied cognition comes from, the idea that, you know, we think of people as being warm and cold, you know, because when we get closer to people, you know, we generate heat with them. And so, you know, intimacy is then connected to warmth and distance, you know, so we can feel far away from someone, close. And it's all because we have these bodies and we're all having a very similar physical experience of moving them around. And at some point we piggyback off of the physical experiencing and say something more abstract. And, you know, with children, you can kind of see it. I think developmentally in children, it starts happening around the ages of 4 to 6. You know, if you tell a 3-year-old, like, do you see what I mean? They're going to look because they think of the word see as only related to sight. But there is like this break off point where developmentally children will start learning that see actually also means to understand.
Yeah, actually, that to be honest, that book that you mentioned, as far as I'm concerned, for me, that is one of the things that to me acts as a great big proof, I suppose, not proof, but like something that to me suggests that there is a really no great big distance between looking at science and art. Like, I think that in some ways they are the same thing. Like, I think that metaphor really is in some ways, I think it's in the same ballpark as describing the laws of something. I mean, for myself, I think about science all the time when I think about art as well. Like, as far as I'm concerned, like, the patterns do repeat. I think that there's something about the relationships between things that appear to occur in reality and also appear to occur in the abstract space. And for me, what is weird about this, so I mentioned this to Brian earlier, where I've noticed in the last while that it has come up among scientists that they complained that artists would draw similarities between scientific phenomena and artistic phenomena, that the notion that, you know, that you can somehow compare these things, that you can do that. And I find this not annoying exactly, but I think it's like purely incorrect. But more disturbingly, I think that this almost pushes the role of art and the value of creativity into something that is further away from reality. The implication is that creativity and art is less real. And like, yeah, sure, it's not mathematics. But the point is that I think that there is like this gradual push towards seeing creativity and art as something that really is not especially tied to the real world, which is nonsense. I think that this is a dangerous thing that leads to more literal thinking and less transference and more like siloing, like no flexibility of thinking between different disciplines.
Yeah, I love that. I think you're absolutely right that it is central, and also that, you know, the use of metaphor in science, or rather, you know, metaphors in art can often affect the trajectories in science. And if we think of metaphors as kind of these contagious kind of ideas about things, then of course, you know, science being also concerned about ideas will be affected by them, right?
Yeah, so I think the most common one that people are critical of is the idea the brain is a computer. I think there's been a number of articles written about how that metaphor has some entailments that, you know, don't work in our benefit in terms of understanding the brain. But there's lots of them. I mean, the problem is, like, you can measure things and that's fine and you can take measurements, but as soon as you put that into language and start explaining them, then you are just in metaphoric language, you know? So you've got, like, evolutionary psychology talks about modules in the brain, and it's not clear whether they're thinking of those metaphorically or whether they're actual things that they're postulating that exist. Or, you know, you've got ideas of, like, there's lots of, like, you know, like sexual predator and evolutionary psychology, where they, you know, you have lots of, like, wild animal in the woods kind of metaphors. So there are all of these things, and they have a certain structure, and they're always going to be wrong in a certain way. And it's fine to point those out, but it's just kind of like you go from one partial structure to the next, which is very unsatisfying when you marry that with kind of empiricism and science, because science is really interested in consilience and the idea that we need all of these things to make this one structure that's entirely cohesive. And language just isn't built that way. It's one partial structure after the next, and they're all cobbled together and they don't really make sense. You know, like, you can give someone your time, but people can't give you your time back. You know, so there's something about the way that time moves forward, but time also can't move backward. You know, so there's all these, like, logical inconsistencies with major concepts major metaphoric concepts that present science with a lot of problems when it starts using them.
Right. The other thing I wanted to say, so I think I was talking with someone recently about Lyra Boroditsky's work about directionality of time. It seems to be quite different in different languages. So in some languages, for example, the past is thought to be in front of you because you can see it, whereas the future is behind you because it is unknown. And there are things like that that are actually particular to our language, but we, you know, a bit like Olga was saying at the beginning, because or with reference to Heron, that once you start speaking in a certain way, it can be very hard to see that that's an assumption, or that that's a, you've kind of got this frame on the world, or you're seeing through a lens, but you forget that you're using that lens or something like that, you know. And also, Jory, I wanted to say that I have not read the Lakoff book, but I've always wondered, because I think it came out like early 80s or something, whether it was influenced by Julian Jaynes, who I mentioned at the beginning. He has a long section on metaphor that it is kind of confusing, but just what you said reminded me of it. So I like opened it up and I just wanted to read a few sentences because it sounded quite similar to what you were saying. And this is from chapter 2 on consciousness. The section is called Metaphor and Language. And Jaynes writes, "Let us speak of metaphor. The most fascinating property of language is its capacity to make metaphors. But what an understatement. For metaphor is not a mere extra trick of language, as it is so often slighted in the old school books on composition. It is the very constitutive ground of language. I am using metaphor here in its most general sense, the use of a term for one thing to describe another because of some kind of similarity between them or between their relations to other things." And so he's kind of saying that metaphor is a primary, you know, it is the primary usage in language, or, you know, and he kind of goes on to say, "The common reply to the question, what is it, when the reply is difficult or the experience unique? Well, it is like," and you might say that's like an analogy, but, or a simile or whatever, but, you know, this equation of the unequal as an answer is, you know, in the broadest sense, it's almost required to understand something. It's like if each word or concept is a tool, then you can kind of put them together in combinations or something like that to extend what you know. And so, I don't know. I'm just thinking aloud now. I might not be making sense.
I think that makes sense, but for me, it goes even further. And I thought this was, you were going to go there in terms of like ready at hand kind of, or the sort of ready-made world out there, or Putnam's kind of idea, versus we're using language all the time, whether it's in science or in art with not only words, but other ways of using metaphor to understand the world in science or in art through the lens we have, through our own consciousness, through our own patterns of thinking, through consensual social ways of seeing and perceiving the world. But the world itself may be entirely disconnect from that. The only way we can communicate with each other, though, is to use those prefabricated concepts or words for the it's the territory map thing, right? For the thing. So even in the basic use of language, we're using metaphor to some degree. When we think about whether it's true or closer to some level of truth of what is out there, right? Does that make sense? I think basically we're using metaphor all the time when we think about physics, and not when we just talk about physics to a layperson or something like that. It's that literally when we're thinking about waves versus particles, they're not necessarily out there, but we use language as a sort of approximation to say that there's something consensual that we understand about the world, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that reminds me of Kuhn's thing. It wouldn't be, you know, a conversation with me if I didn't mention Thomas Kuhn at some point. And he talks about this with the Leyden jar, or just in general with, you know, this effect when seemingly completely at random, like three people discover the same thing at once. And his kind of like proposition for this is like, really what's going on is that everyone's trying out different metaphors, and they're like, well, maybe electricity is like air, or maybe it's like water, or maybe it's like fire or whatever. And then the people who are like, maybe it's like water, they all try the same experiment, which becomes obvious under a certain kind of metaphorical, you know, frame. But like that, the, you know, that this independent discovery is not independent. It actually depends on the almost like a kind of metaphorical contagion or something like that, where these things spread very, very fast and change the way of seeing the problem, you know?
There's lots of, like, when you talk about metaphor, often people have the experience of as they're speaking or as they're listening to other people, they start feeling the metaphors poke out more than normal. And so you kind of have the sense of just being more aware of them. But even in that sense, you're missing like 70 to 80%, you know, because they're so ubiquitous in language. It's almost impossible to see if you don't like really sit down and look. And like a basic one would be something like, you know, are you in a relationship, you know, or are you out? Did you just get out of a relationship? So the idea of being in and out of things, you know, it's almost like a room, like a relationship is a room and you walk in and now you're in the relationship and you walk around in there for a while. And then eventually you might leave and then you're out of the relationship. And so, yeah, to the degree that our object spatial orientation is appropriated to describe more abstract, meaningful things is almost complete. I mean, it's just, it's such a large mapping that we do. And it's very hard, I think, to ever get out of that. If maybe impossible. I mean, that's why when people describe quantum physics, it makes very little sense, because our entire, not just, you know, our experience, but our entire way that we reason is mapped onto Newtonian physical properties, because that's just what we get to experience with our body.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that so much of it is kind of in this unconscious, or maybe even collective unconscious, this long history of etymology, and that's actually adaptive. Like, you can't pay attention to that stuff. And Isabella was saying, you know, Heidegger's got this idea of sort of present at hand versus ready to hand or whatever, which is like when tools are functioning, you express your will like directly through them. Like, you come into the room, you want the light to be on, and you don't pay attention to the light switch, right? It's just like the desire for light kind of manifests almost directly, like unconsciously. But then as soon as, you know, you flip the switch and the light doesn't come on, now suddenly the switch is present at hand. So like, you've switched from this mode where you're expressing in a kind of flow state or something like that. But when you draw attention to the thing itself, then it, you know, it's usually because it hasn't worked well. And so you can have this in conversations where, you know, you're arguing this point about capitalism or religion or whatever, and then, you know, you eventually have to come down to definitions, and then you realize that you're not talking about the same thing at all, you know what I mean? And so there's this sense of that kind of disruption that comes with when a metaphor ceases to function. But just as you were saying, Jory, like, the vast majority of words we use do function transparently, and they almost must. And in that sense, it reminds me a little bit of technology. You know, it's like if you had to be, you know, like your smartphone is made up of all these components that are so complicated that no single human can understand them all, right? But most of them work so well that almost no one needs to, you know what I mean? And so it's like, as long as it's all functioning, that it's just, you know, you can operate at this kind of higher level of abstraction. But sometimes that breaks down and you're forced to go down a level and say, okay, well, what's going on at the meta, you know, at the origin of this word or something like that. I mean, I think the need to resort to etymology is in a certain sense quite rare, but I don't know. That's just what that brought up for me.
No, I completely agree. I think that's one of the reasons why breaking things is so important, right? Why do you need to even to encounter new things is to remind you that you're using the things in the first place. You have to become aware of them, and until you start breaking them, until there's some kind of edge or inconvenience, you're actually maybe not going to recognize what the shape is.
Yeah, I mean, I remember after I read that book, I was just so blown away with, like, oh, well, this, you know, metaphor is the building blocks of meaning, and you can, you know, look at it in this new way and kind of take it apart and put it back together and really understand it at a more basic level. And boy, I bet everybody's going to just be like so fascinated, interested in this. And I would talk to people about it and no one cared, you know, because it's almost like trying to explain to someone how their computer works or how electricity works. Or any of these basic things, it's like, I don't care how it works. I just want to use it for what I want to do with it. But, and like you're saying, like, so the breaking things down maybe only happens when there's a problem, but often in language, it's really not a problem. And you kind of maybe like become aware of it if like you're in a relationship and you're breaking up with someone and they're wanting to know why, right? And so then you have to construct, there's the story that you tell, and the stories might not conflict. You'd be like, well, I don't think this relationship's going anywhere. Or it's like, oh, I think the, you know, the passion or the heat has gone out. Right. And so there's like two conflicting stories. And then you have this like, argument over kind of the metaphoric structure that maybe people might be more aware of it. But even in that, I think it's just largely unconscious. And so, yeah, it's just like, yeah, it's trying to explain how ones and zeros work on the computer. People are just like, no, I just want to surf the internet, you know?
I agree with that. And also, Brian, what you were saying about like looking at the etymology, I think it's related, right? Like, I think being reminded of the initial purpose is very important. So I know very little about philosophy. Most of what I know probably comes from the lecture series that I've been listening to with John Vervaeke, where he makes the point of examining the etymological, the etymology of basically every single concept that he brings up. He just keeps coming back to them all of the time. As far as I can tell, the reason that he does this, or one of the reasons that he does this, is because for him, the more you abstract, the more steps you take towards abstracting something, the further you go away from its literal beginning, the more capacity there is for self-delusion. When, you know, like, and like, this is actually what you're saying. Like, you think that you're, I think Joy, you were saying this earlier as well. Like, you think you're talking about the same thing, but actually you're not. And this is the misunderstanding that actually might be problematic. Not even necessarily that you differ on the viewpoint, but like this misunderstanding is dangerous. So you do kind of have to come back. You do have to examine what was the purpose of that in the first place.
Yeah, I have, it's funny because people keep mentioning Vervaeke to me because I think I'm pushing in a similar direction, which is that there's certain types of abstraction that are maybe more like in some domains it's more safe than others or something like that, and then in other, you know, once you kind of forget, you end up in these map and territory problems, right, where you know, if you're making a map of a map of a map, then you're more likely to run into you know, issues once you hit the territory, you know. And so Isabella, do you have any, I know you've engaged a little bit with that, are you?
No, I cannot actually add much to Olga's Vervaeke. I think you're absolutely right. I think first of all, there's something really important about the teaching method of kind of iterating and resurfacing similar concepts from different angles and seeing how there's some kind of sense of not progression as in like we're getting like there's nothing goal oriented necessarily, but that there's a sense of trying to understand where thinkers have moved, and that there is some sort of coherency to this search for meaning and so on and you know, suffering and all that. Yeah, I don't have much to add to your thinking about that, but I totally agree. And I love this conversation, by the way, the ease with which we're moving from, you know, folk Russian dance to, you know, conceptions of science and metaphor and so on. It's just really rich. So I just thank you for that.
No, likewise. I was actually really nervous about having this conversation. You know, I was quite scared. I wasn't sure if it would make any kind of sense. So I'm massively relieved to understand you and that you appear to understand me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I absolutely understand you, Olga. And I think, it's been a great conversation. We should do it more often, I think. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So I might have to go soon just because, like, Rob is here, and I think at some point I'm going to have to get going. But, yes, we should come back to this, if only because I was really gripped with something else that you said in your podcast where you were quoting Ian McGilchrist, and it was to do with this. It was, so he said, for the romantic mind, theory was not something abstracted from experience and separate from it based on representation, but present in the act of perception. There is therefore no question of applying theory to life, since phenomena themselves were the source of theory. Fact and theory, like particular universal, were not opposites. They are not only intimately connected, but interpenetrate each other, and the particular represents the universal. So as far as I'm concerned, this is why a later revisiting would be so valuable, because, God help me, I could be wrong, but I have a feeling that what Marshall McLuhan writes about with the medium as the message, I think that's the same damn thing. I think that there's something about, I think that there's something about, like, trying to manifest meaning, but inside the things that you're doing it with, that there is a very strange emulsion there, something very odd, where the doing is the thinking, and the interaction is the thinking, and then the conclusion is also, it cannot be separated from that.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so that was the last one I did, right, on Wings of Desire, a little while ago. Yeah, I will share the link for that. Isabella, did you have something?
Well, I just, let's please continue this discussion, because you can't just drop that all done and say, like, okay, we should talk. Yes, absolutely. I think these ideas are also interlinked, and I think we've just started. I have to leave right now, unfortunately, but I got to tell you, I am, like, super excited about this conversation, so I hope you guys do it again.
Thank you. Yeah. Jory, any last comments before we close it?
Oh, sure. So, yeah, I love the conversation. Thanks. This has been great. Just to the degree that, you know, metaphor penetrates not just our language, but it, you know, it's multimodal. And so it also is expressed in the way that in our body language. So there's all sorts of research on gesture and metaphor where, as we're speaking, we're essentially enacting the unsaid parts of metaphors out with our body. It's, of course, in images, in paintings, all through art. You know, metaphors can be physical actions that we take with our body. So it's like a common, like, movie scene, you know, when people, something terrible has happened to them, and then they go and they take a shower, right? And so it's like the physical action of, I'm not just washing dirt off my body, but I'm washing an experience off of my body. So it is, like, deeply penetrative to all of these domains outside of language. I guess that's what I just want to say.
Thank you so much. And yeah, thanks for coming up and contributing. I really enjoyed this conversation and hope we can do another one soon. Thank you, Olga.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I am so often overwhelmed by wanting to talk to people about these things, and people in my sphere, in my colleagues. Jory, it's, you know, what you were saying about examining the metaphors, you know, I so desperately want to talk about the work that we do with the other people who do the same work as me. And they do not engage. And I think partly it is simply the desire to not make life more complicated for themselves in a way that it becomes extremely inconvenient, but partly because I think that they haven't quite looked close enough, and that I find it so frustrating and sad. And I this is the only thing I know. And I would like to be able to explore more with people who have examined it from other directions. So this is so valuable.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, this has been great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jory. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Would love to have you up on a new one. I do these conversations on Sundays in general. I will tweet out a link if you want to sign up to do one on any topic that you wish. And yeah, it would be great to hear from some of you soon.
Until next time, thank you. Have a nice Sunday.